but too slow to be a problem for you. Not necessarily true, Rapp knew. While the U.S. had been successful at shutting down cell and satellite communication in the area, they hadn't been able to do much about short-range radio. It was possible that the patrol ahead of them knew what was happening in town and was looking for them. Understood. Stand by. Rapp looked over at Mohammed and switched to Arabic. We've got a patrol coming in our direction. A patrol? He said, twisting in his seat. What do you mean? There are no turns off this road. Calm down. We're going to be fine. You're probably going to have to take over driving, though. Just stay on the road and follow the directions I gave you to the LZ.
I don't understand.
His words came out in a barely comprehensible jumble.
Why would I have to drive? What are you going to do? Where will you be?
Rapp ignored him, instead banging a fist on the window behind him. A moment later, Ghaffar leaned around and stuck his bearded face in the open driver's side window. Do we have a problem, Mitch? Maybe, maybe not. There's a patrol coming down on us. Tell everyone to look friendly. He nodded and pulled back into the bed to get his people in line.
Mitch, Mohammed started.
Not now, Rapp responded. A slight glow was becoming visible in the distance, but it wasn't the approaching patrol that made him grip the wheel tighter. It was Mohammed's face in his peripheral vision.
I need to ask you a question.
Rapp remained silent, hoping that the young Iraqi would lose his train of thought as the threat of the men coming at them increased. Not surprisingly, the opposite was the case. Mohammed didn't want to leave this world without knowing how his sister had died.
What happened to Lale, Mitch?
General Mustafa was stabbed to death and we found her body lying next to his, with a gunshot wound to the chest.
You were there, weren't you? When she was killed?
Again, Rapp didn't answer. The oncoming patrol vehicle wasn't going to save him, though. It seemed to be moving in slow motion. She had a knife, he said finally. I didn't see it. She attacked Mustafa. Mohammed nodded, a vengeful smile just barely visible in the glow of the gauges.
My brother thought it was you who had killed that pig. But I knew. Lala was the strongest of us. Ever since we were children.
Rapp pressed harder on the accelerator, but the truck wouldn't respond. Even downhill, 35 miles an hour was all it would give him. The silence between them lasted only a few seconds before Mohammed broke it.
So, one of General Mustafa's guards shot her?
Rapp knew he could lie. No one would ever know. He was the only living witness to what had happened.
Mitch?
It wasn't one of the guards. He'd known this conversation was inevitable when he'd come back for Mohammed and his people. And he'd made his decision about what to say long before he'd set out for Iraq. Lale deserved to have her story known. Her real story.
Who then?
I shot her. The general was bleeding out on the floor. His guards were going to take her. He wasn't sure how Mohammed would react, but was surprised when he just sank a little deeper in his seat. Where the fuck was that patrol? Anything would be better than having to sit here and talk about Lale. He was just starting to be able to sleep through the night without her memory jerking him awake.
I know what ISIS does to women who defy them, Mohammed said finally. Like you, I've witnessed it personally.
And I've seen what's left of their bodies after. He put a hand on Rapp's shoulder.
Me and my brother are the only people left from my family. And on behalf of both of us, I want to thank you for having the courage to do what had to be done. I know how hard it would be for an American, even one like you.
A set of headlights appeared from over a rise in front of them, and Rapp tried to determine whether the road's shoulder was solid enough to divert onto if the oncoming patrol tried to block them. Not a chance. The sand had drifted into a soft ridge alongside the roadbed, and ahead it grew into a low cliff.
What are we going to do? Mohammed asked.
Nothing. For now, just sit there. The intensity of the headlights grew until Rap had to pull down the visor in an effort to protect what night vision he had. He eased as far right as he could and hovered a foot over the brake in case the patrol turned sideways in the road. At 100 yards, it became clear that the vehicle was similar to their own, a small pickup with two men in the cab and more standing in the bed. Unless the driver was an idiot, he would resist the urge to do anything sudden out of fear of throwing his men into the road. At 50 yards, Mohammed reached for the pistol in his waistband.
"Are you sure we shouldn't? Don't do anything."
He heard Ghaffar shout a greeting that wasn't returned. The men in the truck just stared at them as they passed. Rap drifted back to the center of the road, focused on the rearview mirror. 25 yards. 50. Suddenly, the men in the bed of the ISIS truck crouched to steady themselves.
Shit.
What? Mohammed twisted around in time to see the truck skid 90 degrees to a stop. Rap shoved the accelerator to the floor without much effect as the truck behind them struggled to turn around without getting bogged down. "Take the wheel," he said, throwing open the door and stepping onto the running board. He found Ghaffar already in motion, gathering mags from the terrified people around him. "All right, listen to me," Rap said to Mohammed as the man slid into the driver's seat. "We're going to start up the hill, and when we circle behind that cliff, you're going to slow down enough for me and Ghaffar to jump. Use the parking brake. We don't want the brake lights to go on. Do you understand?" He gave a jerky nod, keeping his hands locked around the wheel at 2 and 10 o'clock. Rap swung into the bed and accepted an assault rifle along with 3 magazines.
"What's the plan?"
Ghaffar shouted over the wind.
"We're getting out. You take the high ground to the east of the road. I'll set up in the sand to the west. You shoot first. Drive them to me."
Ghaffar nodded. The patrol vehicle finally managed to turn around and its engine was audible as the driver pushed it to the limit. Unlike the little service vehicle they were stuck in, the one chasing them was a late-model Toyota Tacoma. By the time Mohammed got them around the cliff and started to slow, the patrol truck had already cut the distance between them in half. Velocity was hard to judge in the dark monochromatic landscape, so Rap looked through the back window, waiting for the speedometer to reach 15 miles an hour. When it did, he threw his AK over the side and jumped out after it, clearing the road and landing in the softer sand at its edge. Ghaffar, heavier and less athletic, came up short and hit harder, rolling across the road surface before coming to a stop. Rap scooped up both weapons and ran to him.
"You alive?"
"I'm fine," he said, rising unsteadily. Rap grabbed the man's hands and jerked back on them. Ghaffar managed to resist and maintain his balance without too much difficulty. He was just shaken up. No damage done. Rap handed over one of the weapons. There wasn't much time. The approaching engine was getting louder. The Iraqi ran toward the cliff at the edge of the road, while Rap retreated into the desert on the other side. He glanced back and saw Ghaffar scrambling to high ground, looking solid and making decent time. The glare of headlights was growing in intensity, increasing the sense of urgency, but also allowing Rap to move more quickly over the uneven ground. He crested a small sand drift and dropped to his stomach on the other side. Aiming into the oncoming headlights wouldn't be optimal, but Ghaffar didn't have to be all that precise. He just needed to put the fear of God into these pricks. The truck rounded the corner fast enough to lift onto 2 wheels. It had barely managed to straighten out when Ghaffar opened up on the windshield. Unfortunately, the men in back were well braced and the truck didn't roll. Instead, it just lost power and slowed as the driver slumped against the steering wheel. The men in the bed leapt out as the vehicle began to grind against the cliff. There were 8 of them, and all looked uninjured. By contrast, both men in the cab appeared to be either dead or incapacitated. 4 went for the cliff, taking cover directly below Ghaffar, where they would be invisible to him. The others were running directly at Rap. Ghaffar took 1 out when he was still 15 yards away, but it was a lucky shot. The truck's headlights had been damaged by its impact with the cliff, and Ghaffar wasn't going to be able to reliably hit crouched running men in the moonlight. Rapp's earpiece crackled to life, but this time it wasn't Marcus Dumond. The voice belonged to Fred Mason, his go-to chopper pilot on operations like these. "Mitch, I'm inbound and I'm seeing a lot of commotion to the southwest. Are you kicking up dust over there?" "That's an affirmative." "You need help?" The three remaining men had closed to within 10 feet and Rapp fired, sweeping across them. Two dropped immediately, but one made it a few more steps before falling into the sand right in front of Rapp. "No, continue on your heading. Your cargo should be arriving at the LZ in about 15. What about you?" "We'll play that by ear." The men huddled at the base of the cliff had seen the flashes of his rifle and began pummeling the dune Rapp was ensconced behind. The body in front of him jerked with bullet impacts, and Rapp slithered back a few feet before starting to crawl south. After a few seconds, the guns went silent. The terrorists would have no way to confirm a kill and would want to conserve their ammunition. After covering 50 yards, Rapp slung the rifle across his back and darted across the road. The scramble up the cliff took longer than it should have, but he had to remain silent. Not because of the assholes behind the truck, though. Because of Ghaffar. They had no way to communicate, and he was going to be looking for anyone coming up behind him. Rapp swung well into the desert before cutting back. Moving slowly and focusing on every footfall, it took another 3 minutes before he spotted Ghaffar lying at the edge of the cliff. Rapp came up directly from behind and put a hand on the man's back. He jerked and started to spin, but Rapp held him to the ground. "Relax, it's me." The Arab let out a long, wavering breath as Rapp dropped next to him. "Don't ever do that again." "They're not moving?" "No. They seem suspiciously comfortable where they are. I think we can assume that they've called for help." Rapp nodded in the darkness. "How fast are you on foot?"
"Middle of my graduating class in the army."
"So, not very fast." Rapp activated his throat mic. "Marcus, you copy?"
"Yeah, I'm here."
"Have you got a bead on us?"
"You're kinda hard to miss."
"Do we have incoming?"
4 trucks, all full. ETA to your position is probably 10 minutes.
"Can you reliably track a man in the desert?"
"With thermal, sure."
"Okay, I'm handing my radio over to Ghaffar. You're going to have to give him instructions on how to get to the LZ from here. He doesn't speak English, though, so call down for a translator."
"Okay, Mitch, no problem."
"Fred," Rapp said, "are you copying this?"
"Affirmative."
"Give me a sit rep."
"I have eyes on your people, and I'm getting ready to land."
"Pick them up and get back in the air. Then stand by."
"Roger that."
He removed his earpiece and throat mic, handing them to Ghaffar. "Your heading is due east to the LZ. It's going to be about 8 kilometers over moderately difficult terrain. Keep a reasonable pace. Don't blow yourself up and don't fall in any holes."
"What are you going to do?"
"Keep these guys down long enough to give you a head start."
"No, I won't leave you here. We should—
You'll be too slow for me out there. Go now, and I'll catch you."
The Arab reluctantly turned and crawled a few yards before getting to his feet and accelerating to a careful jog. Rapp settled into the silence. The wind was completely dead, and nothing around him moved. He was completely on his own. A pleasant change from the babysitting he'd been doing over the last few hours. He didn't have to wait long for the illusion of peacefulness to be shattered. Not by the sound of oncoming trucks, but by a quiet rustling from below. A moment later, he saw the dark outline of a man break cover for a split second and then jerk back. Rapp just sat there. A few moments later, the man showed himself again, this time for a bit longer. Again, Rapp did nothing. Finally, the shadow came out from behind the truck and began skirting the cliff. Rapp gave him a long leash, hoping that his companions would get overconfident and follow. When he started climbing toward Rapp's position, though, it became clear that the other surviving men had decided to sit tight and wait for reinforcements. Rapp fired a single shot, hitting the man in the stomach and sending him toppling back to the road. A few shouts followed, but no one was stupid enough to go to the aid of their wounded companion. Not a big surprise, but it had been worth a try. A few minutes passed quietly before headlights appeared to the south. Rapp watched them as excited voices once again became audible below. Four vehicles coming fast. Whatever Ghaffar's head start was, it would have to be enough. Rapp stood and began running into the desert as the convoy continued to bear down. He figured he was about doubling Ghaffar's pace, slowed slightly by the fact that the only way for him to navigate to the LZ was to follow the man's tracks in the moonlight. He'd only made it about 500 yards when the shooting started. It sounded like the reinforcements had arrived, and that all of them were firing on full auto. No point in looking back. He assumed that they'd pulverize the top of the cliff he'd been staked out on, and then charged en masse. Isis was not known for its subtlety. He covered another quarter mile before temporarily losing Ghaffar's footprints on a rocky plateau. The man was smart enough not to change direction, and Rapp picked them up again in the sand on the other side. The news wasn't all good, though. Behind, he could see no fewer than 10 flashlights coming his way. The lead one was using the advantage of artificial illumination to good effect, and actually seemed to be closing. Rapp considered abandoning Ghaffar's tracks in favor of speed. But it wasn't time for that yet. There was a whole lot of desert out there. To the east, a dull glow was starting on the horizon. The light improved his speed, but it also robbed him of his cover, something that became evident when shots sounded behind him. He glanced back and estimated the distance to the closest chaser at more than 600 yards. A doable shot with the right equipment and training, but they seemed to have neither. Just a little youthful jihadi enthusiasm. The question was how long this was going to go on. Did Marcus have a position on him? Was Fred willing to fly in on a force of probably 30 armed men? His question was answered a moment later when the thump of rotors became audible ahead. With the sunlight angling in, he was able to pick up his pace to the maximum his lungs would allow, increasing the gap between him and his pursuers. If he could gain some ground, the chopper would be able to touch down long enough to get him aboard. Apparently, Mason didn't want to wait. He passed overhead, banking north as the sound of his door gun shook the air. Rapp glanced back and saw the arcing laser light of the tracers sweeping across the Isis force. He kept pushing, dropping his rifle to get rid of as much weight as possible as he angled down a steep slope. It was a risky move that could give Isis the high ground, but if he moved fast enough, it would provide temporary cover. The door gun went silent, replaced by the roar of rotors. The chopper came in low enough for him to feel the pressure of its downdraft. The skids were still 2 feet above the ground when Rapp dove through the open door. Mason started climbing again as Muhammad pulled Rapp the rest of the way inside and Ghaffar opened up with the door gun again. The terrorists managed to get off a few shots, but none came anywhere near them as they turned toward the sunrise. Chapter 6 Rabat, Morocco. "The Saudi and his men are back in the car and on the move," Charlie Wicker said over Maslick's earpiece. "Al-Ghani is hauling ass to the north. He's got the case, but it looks too light to have anything in it." "Copy that. Let me know when I should go." "Probably about a minute." "Copy." Maslick would have preferred to take the courier during his meeting with Al-Ghani, but there were too many uncontrollable factors. The apartment building had no fewer than 30 residents packed into it, including 9 women and 12 kids. Worse, the souk where it was located was too narrow for a vehicle. That would have forced them to go in on foot and then drag their target back to the car. While it was true that there wasn't much activity on the street at this hour, it was also true that Murphy's Law ruled the business he'd chosen. The plan they'd landed on was pretty simple, which was the only kind worth dealing with as far as he was concerned. There was just one way out for the courier, a road that was barely wide enough for a single car. Maslick would pull out in front of the Mercedes, and Bruno McGraw would come in from behind.
When they were directly beneath Wick's rooftop position, they'd box the target vehicle in, snatch this son of a bitch, and be gone. The whole thing had been slated to take less than a minute, and with a little luck, would go completely unnoticed. But now that elegant little plan had been blown to shit. Instead of a scrawny middle-aged Egyptian in a tin can of a car, he was dealing with three men, two undoubtedly armed, barricaded in an armored vehicle.
"Maz, you're a go," Wicker said over his earpiece. He started the vehicle and moved out into the dark road.
A man with a wheeled cart was coming in his direction, apparently getting an early start on setting up for the morning's shoppers. Maslick eased to the right of the vendor, grinding off part of his side-view mirror on one of the buildings crowding the asphalt. Fuck it, it was a rental.
"Okay, Maz, you're about 100 yards ahead, paralleling them. Maintain your speed after the turn and you should be good."
He stayed on course for another 25 yards and then took a left, keeping the vehicle at a leisurely 15 miles an hour as it closed on a T in the road.
"You're good. He's still 50 yards out. Bruno's coming up behind him."
"Roger that." Maslick turned right and was immediately dazzled by the glare of headlights in his rearview mirror. With the new reality on the ground, there was no way they were going to be able to quietly box in their target. Instead, Maslick was going to have to slam on his brakes and let the Mercedes ram him from behind. It wouldn't be enough to injure anyone inside, but the airbag deployment would slow down any reaction, and Wick had ammunition that would penetrate the windshield. That would leave the man in back undefended, but accessing him was still going to be a noisy and potentially time-consuming trick. So while they could still achieve their objective of getting the courier, though apparently the wrong one, they were going to leave two smashed cars and two dead men instead of the brief disturbance he'd planned on. Not ideal, but also not enough to call it off. It wasn't like Rap hadn't broken a few dishes on these kinds of ops in the past. "Maz, do you copy?"
"Wick again."
"Yeah, go ahead."
"We got a hit on that picture I sent to Langley.
79% probability that the guy in the back of that car is his royal shithead, Prince Talal bin Musaid of Saudi Arabia."
"You've got to be kidding me."
"Nope." Maslick started to sweat again, despite the cool air flowing through the window. The target was only 20 yards behind him now, approaching fast. Time was running out. In less than an eighth of a mile, the constricted corridor would open up and the powerful Mercedes would go by him like he was stopped in the road. So now they weren't just talking about a messy snatch and grab. They were talking about a messy snatch and grab of a Saudi royal. Bad. But still not a disaster. There were about 1,000 of these anonymous princes roaming the world, so he wasn't going to get his panties too bunched up about it. His job was to deliver the ISIS money man. What Rapp and Irene Kennedy did with him was their business. They were right on his tail now, and he could see the outline of the two men in the front seat of the Mercedes. Maslick suddenly realized that it was possible, probable, really, that they were just guards employed by the Saudi embassy to cart around visiting VIPs. Not terrorists. Not criminals. Just a couple former soldiers making a living.
"Maz, we've got some more intel coming in. Bin Musaid's 39, wife and two kids who live in Riyadh, but he seems to get around. The U.S., Canada, Europe. He's worked for the Saudi government in the past, but not for a few years. No known job right now."
Maz was feeling increasingly uncertain. "That seems like a lot of detail for us to have on some random prince."
"That's probably because he's not some random prince. He's King Faisal's nephew."
"What? Repeat that."
"I said the agency probably has all this intel because he's King Faisal's nephew. His dead sister's son, it looks like."
Fuck. In his rearview mirror, he could see Bruno McGraw taking up a position 30 feet behind the Mercedes. Maslick was having trouble focusing on the image, though. It was being pushed from his mind by the thought that he was about to kill two innocent embassy workers and grab the nephew of the king of one of America's primary allies in the Middle East.
This had just gone from dealing with some bitching from the Moroccans to a major international incident, with 2 counts of murder thrown in for good measure. Then, of course, there would be the official protests to the UN. The American politicians making grandstanding speeches about the out-of-control CIA, the calls for Irene Kennedy's resignation, and him standing right in the middle of all of it. "Maz," Bruno McGraw said over his earpiece, "what are we doing? You're coming up to the end of the road." Maslick reached for the phone on his dashboard, but there was no time to get authorization. His foot hovered over the brake for a moment, then shoved down on the accelerator instead. "Abort. I repeat, abort. Wick, go get the money from that apartment. Bruno, peel off east. We'll rendezvous at the airstrip in 2. Chapter 7. Outside of Washington, D.C., USA. The CIA's Gulfstream G550 was on its final approach, heading into the setting sun as it descended toward the treetops. Rapp was stretched out on the sofa with his phone pressed to his ear.
"When you say ready, Mitch, what exactly do you mean?"
"I mean that my car is parked next to the fucking airstrip like you promised." This landing site was Rapp's go-to when flying into the D.C. area, quiet and out of the way, but still less than an hour from his house.
"Yeah, about that," Craig Baylor responded nervously.
"Gunter isn't done with the subwoofer."
"Who's Gunter?"
"The Swiss dude making your sub. Look, Mitch, the guy's an artist and you can't rush artists. Trust me, man. It's gonna be worth the wait. Not only are you finally going to have a kick-ass stereo, but I've also knocked 40 kilos off the Kevlar without any effect on integrity. Plus, you're going to have built-in encrypted phone and internet. How's that going to help me on my 40-mile walk home?"
"I told Claudia it wouldn't be done.
Are you two?" Rapp disconnected the call. His efforts to get his life together had been just successful enough to remind him that having a life was a monumental pain in the ass. After his wife had been killed, he'd jettisoned almost everything. Family, friends, possessions. And while the existence that remained had been admittedly empty, it had also been wonderfully simple. A sparse one-bedroom apartment, a flawless backup team, and work. The lack of extraneous moving parts kept everything rolling along with a satisfying precision. Rapp sat up and looked out the window. The deserted airfield was a powerful reminder of the fact that the simplicity he'd become so comfortably numb to was gone, cheerfully and thoroughly shredded by Claudia Gould. Her husband had been one of the top private contractors in the world until Stan Hurley ripped his throat out. Rapp had set Claudia and her daughter up with clean identities and a new life in South Africa. But it hadn't lasted. The Russians tracked them down and forced him to pull them out. In return for helping finish the construction of his new house, he'd let the two of them move in. It was a temporary accommodation that was turning out to be not so temporary. So now he and Claudia had settled into an uncomfortably platonic cohabitation that was starting to feel like a low-grade Cold War. He was always able to find an excuse not to send them back to Cape Town, but couldn't seem to dig up the courage to commit. Even after so many years, the death of his wife was a raw, bleeding wound. The years had proved that there wasn't much that could kill him. Living through another loss like that, though, might. Which brought him back to the empty airfield. Was Claudia making some kind of statement by not being there? Was she telling him that he needed to either make a move or walk away? It would be a fair point, though out of character. Her style was to have it out face to face. And why not? She was a deadly opponent in those kinds of confrontations. The wheels touched down and Rapp went forward, grabbing his duffel and opening the door. He jumped out and immediately turned away from the cockpit. The pilots hadn't seen his face, and he preferred to keep it that way. The Gulfstream immediately took to the air again, leaving him standing among the lengthening shadows. His cell was in his pocket, but he didn't want to use it. Had he completely missed the fact that his relationship with Claudia had deteriorated to the point that she'd leave him there? Or was she just forcing him to sit and think about his situation for a while? Either way, she was justified. He was blowing it. A vehicle appeared in the distance, but it wasn't Claudia's Audi Q5. Rapp's hand moved closer to the Glock beneath his jacket, but then fell to his side when he recognized the SUV belonging to Scott Coleman. It rolled to a stop, and Rapp tossed his duffel inside before slipping into the passenger seat.
"How'd it go?" Coleman asked.
Everyone got out.
"Did you pass along my job offer to Ghaffar?"
Rapp shook his head. Turns out he was an artist before he was a soldier. He wants to learn English and go to work for an advertising agency.
No shit.
Rapp watched the deliberate movement of Coleman's arm as he put the vehicle in gear. The injuries the former SEAL had suffered in Pakistan were far worse than Rapp's own. It was a minor miracle that he was alive, and a major one that he could walk. He was working on his rehab full-time, but the slow progress had left yet another glitch in Rapp's well-oiled machine. Coleman's outfit, SEAL Demolition and Salvage, had been his primary backup for years. With its founder out of commission, they had been forced to put a reluctant Joe Maslick in charge. And while Maz was a hell of an operator, he was no Scott Coleman.
"Where's Claudia?" Rapp said.
There was no point in hiding from the subject.
"Apparently there's a sleepover at your house tonight, and she has her hands full." He was surprised at the relief he felt.
She hadn't been expecting to have to pick him up, and it was entirely plausible that Anna had friends over. Maybe this wasn't her drawing a line in the sand.
"So why are you here?"
"Somebody had to come and get your ass."
That story sounded a bit thin. Sitting for extended periods of time was hard for him, and he had people he could have sent. There was more to this, and it wasn't hard to guess what it was.
"What happened in Rabat?" Rapp said.
Coleman didn't immediately answer, instead accelerating up the road.
"There was a problem."
"Are any of our guys hurt?"
"Nah, they're all fine."
"And the Egyptian?"
"There was no Egyptian, Mitch.
Our intel was bad. The courier was a Saudi prince."
"Do we have him?"
"So the thing is, do we have him?"
"No."
"Why the fuck not?"
"He was traveling in an armored vehicle, and there were two guards with—
"You're telling me that Maz, Bruno, and Wick can't handle two guards and a little armor?"
"What I'm telling you is that the prince in question is Faisal's nephew."
"I don't give a shit who he is. I told—"
"Mitch, please, let me finish. We threw Maz headlong into this and told him it was a nobody ISIS courier. He didn't feel like he had the authority to make the call, and there wasn't time to get to Irene.
So he just walked away."
"In a nutshell, yeah."
Rapp tried to control his anger. The Saudis had gotten pass after pass. They were an anti-democratic monarchy, the world's largest supporter of terrorist organizations, and funded the countless madrasas that churned out an endless stream of radicals to replace the ones he killed. And now King Faisal's worthless nephew was rolling around Morocco with a briefcase full of cash earmarked for ISIS.
"Do we have proof?"
"That it was bin Musaid? Not ironclad. But we have a pretty decent photo taken through Wick's scope."
"Where is he now?"
"He hasn't popped back up on our radar yet. We're watching. I mean Maslick."
"Oh, somewhere in Europe. He's afraid to come back. He doesn't want to face you."
They drove in silence for a good 5 minutes before Coleman spoke again.
"You keep avoiding the subject, but we can't anymore. We've got to talk about finding a replacement for me until I can get my shit together. You need reliable backup, and I guarantee if you put Maz in charge of anything again, he's going to quit. I don't want it to be my fault if another op goes south, or if you get shot up. I'd never hear the end of it from Irene."
He was right, Rapp knew. The hope had been that Coleman would bounce back in a few months. But that wasn't happening. It could easily be another year. Or As much as no one wanted to face the possibility, it could be never.
It's your organization, Scott, not mine. You can do what you want. Coleman seemed to relax a little.
But it's your ass out there. I need you to be comfortable with who I pick.
Do you have any ideas?
Mike Nash and I have been doing some spitballing. We've turned up a few names, and he's digging a little deeper for me. We've also been talking about splitting the job in two. Maybe having a separate field commander and logistics person.
So you'd handle logistics, then?
The former SEAL shook his head. I've got more on my plate than I can deal with right now.
Rapp felt increasingly uncomfortable with the conversation. The more they talked about a replacement, the more it felt like Coleman wasn't coming back. They'd been together for years. In many ways, they'd grown up together in the business. Beyond the friendship they'd forged, there was a level of trust that he didn't see being able to rebuild with someone new.
Coleman seemed to read his mind. Another facet of their relationship that was going to be hard to replace.
It's just for a little while, Mitch. I need this, okay? I'm stressing out that you or one of my guys is going to get killed. I don't need that right now.
When's Mike going to have some recommendations?
Next day or two. He's working on the ops side. I'm dealing with logistics.
And?
Again, Coleman didn't immediately answer, instead focusing on getting around a truck creeping along the rural highway. He seemed to be building up to something, but Rapp had no idea what it could be.
It's hard not to think about Claudia, the former SEAL said finally. For the second time since he'd gotten in the car, Rapp found himself having to control his anger. Normally he wouldn't bother, but Coleman was struggling. He'd gone from being one of the best operators in the world to barely being able to roll out of bed in the morning. He felt like he'd abandoned his comrades and was terrified that he might live the rest of his life getting winded buying groceries.
No, Rapp said. She's already risking enough just being near me.
To be clear here, Mitch, I didn't approach her. She approached me. And we both know that a big part of Louis Gould's success was her doing most of the thinking for him.
We're done with this subject, Scott.
Coleman shrugged. All right. As far as I'm concerned, it's a dead issue. But I'm not sure Claudia is going to feel the same way.
Chapter 8 Rabat, Morocco. Prince Talal bin Musaid stepped into the Learjet 75's cool interior and frowned at the pilot bowing to him from the cockpit door. He'd never seen the man before, but it mattered little. The pilots he'd been provided in the past had been adequate, and he had no reason to believe that this one would be any different.
Welcome, Your Highness. All is ready for your return to Riyadh.
Make me a drink, bin Musaid said, and then went to the back, taking a seat. He watched disinterestedly as the pilot closed the door and then rushed to pour a single malt for his only passenger.
Do I have your permission to lift off? He said, handing bin Musaid the drink with another bow.
The prince nodded and took a sip from the crystal glass. Not his preferred brand, but it would do for the relatively short flight. He savored the dark liquor without guilt, as he did women, drugs, and gambling. Why not? He had been shut out of his rightful place by old men fearful of his youth and vitality. Certainly Allah would understand him taking solace in these meaningless vices until the order of things changed. Until the storm that was brewing in the Middle East finally destroyed the Western appeasers who infested the region. As the engine spooled up, he wondered idly what had happened to the money he'd provided ISIS. Was it being passed along their elaborate network on its way to America? Had it been laundered and deposited in a legitimate financial institution? Was it already in the hands of the devout men who would use it for a glorious attack?
What would the target be?
An American sports stadium? One of the country's decadent commercial centers? The Capitol building during a meeting of its Congress?
Freedom made the Americans weak.
How could a society protect itself unless the greater men took charge of every aspect? How could a society be truly exceptional when it was at the mercy of the whims of the mob? His own country was slowly succumbing to a similar fate, he knew. King Faisal and the leaders who had come before him had turned their backs on Allah. The old man had retreated behind the walls of his depraved palace, emerging occasionally to falsely proclaim his devotion to subjects who were beginning to see through his lies. He had abandoned the almighty power of God long ago, replacing it with the power of America. Like all bargains with the devil, though, this one was beginning to unravel. The vast network of conservative madrasas financed by the House of Saud were no longer blinding the people to its excesses, but instead showing them the truth. The king was now faced with an impossible situation. His strategy of publicly condemning the U.S. while privately supporting its battle against fundamentalist Islamic forces was beginning to fail. And the Americans were finally waking up to the fact that the billions they spent on Saudi oil was being used to create terrorists, whom they then had to spend billions fighting. This increasing dysfunction had culminated in the recent action ISIS had taken against his own country. They had acquired radioactive material from Pakistan and attempted to use it to irradiate Saudi Arabia's oil-producing region. In the ensuing economic chaos, Faisal and his lackeys would have fled to the West, leaving the forces of true Islam to take control of not only Saudi Arabia, but the trillions of dollars worth of sophisticated weapons the Americans had sold its military. It was a magnificent plan, but one that had never come to pass. The murderer Mitch Rapp had thwarted the attack. Now King Faisal was bowing and scraping even more to the Americans, begging men like Rapp to provide enough stability to protect him in the last few years of his life. After that, Faisal cared little about what happened to his country and the religion that should have been under his protection. The plane accelerated a bit abruptly up the runway, and Bin Musaid struggled to keep his drink from spilling. He was about to shout an insult in the direction of the cockpit, but then reconsidered. He would soon rise to a position from which he would lead the Arab people. A king of kings acting as God's representative on earth. Personally interacting with this man was beneath him. A brief mention to one of his people when they landed would ensure the pilot never worked again. Bin Musaid's phone rang, and he glanced down to see the recently appointed Saudi intelligence chief Ali Nassar's name on the screen. He ignored it. Nassar was undoubtedly strong and had proven intelligent enough to identify Bin Musaid as an ally. But he was also a commoner. It was a fact that he seemed to be forgetting as his power grew. While his machinations were unquestionably impressive, they were entirely for the benefit of the next generation of Saudi aristocrats. When Bin Musaid took his rightful seat as the head of the House of Saud, he would of course reward Nassar's efforts lavishly, but he would also forcefully remind the man that he was a servant, a valuable one to be sure, but a servant nonetheless. The plane leveled out and the pilot immediately made his way back to him. Your Highness, Ali Nassar is trying to contact you. He wonders if perhaps your phone is not functioning properly. Bin Musaid stared up at the man. My phone is functioning perfectly. I don't understand, Your Highness. I'm not interested in what you do or do not understand. Knowing that he'd been dismissed, the pilot retreated back to the cockpit. Before Bin Musaid could take another sip of his drink, though, he had returned, this time with a phone in his hand. I'm sorry, but I'm told it's urgent. Bin Musaid let out a frustrated breath and snatched the phone. What? You went personally. You were to leave the money for the Egyptian and let him make the exchange.
You'd do well to watch your tone when you speak to me, Ali. It was my money, and I wanted to meet the man taking it. Watch my tone? Idiot! You know nothing of this, Bin Musaid shouted. You sit in your office in Riyadh, using other people's funds and labor to advance your plans. You would be able to do nothing. You would be nothing without the support of my family. It never occurred to you that you could be seen, that your involvement might be discovered? Impossible. You drove there in a car provided by the embassy. Do you have any idea what your thoughtless arrogance has put at risk? Have you... Bin Musaid disconnected the call and threw the phone against the bulkhead. Who was Ali Nassar to speak to him like that? He was a pauper, one of the thousands of meaningless bureaucrats who infested Saudi Arabia's government payroll. The fact that he had temporarily gained the favor of the useless old woman who was their king had caused him to become drunk with self-importance. The pilot apparently had a second phone, because it began ringing almost immediately. Surely, he would not be stupid enough to bring it back again. Bin Musaid swallowed what was left of his drink and went to the galley to pour himself a second. A third and fourth would probably also be necessary to soften both the memory of that conversation and the fact that he was being forced to return to Riyadh. He'd spend only the number of days required to keep up appearances. The moment his familial obligations were fulfilled, he would leave again, perhaps for New York. He had an interesting woman there and a sudden yearning to walk among the godless inhabitants of that country, to revel in their ignorance of what was to come. Allahu Akbar! The sudden shout from the pilot was followed by the nose of the plane dipping violently and the fuselage beginning to vibrate. Bin Musaid lurched for the cockpit, but the angle of descent continued to steepen. A moment later, he was weightless, feeling panic grip him as the aircraft dropped below the clouds and revealed the earth rushing toward them. He screamed, but it came out as more of a whimper, swallowed up by the sound of rushing air and the deafening whine of the engines. The sensation of weight returned suddenly, and he hit the floor, rolling through the food, dishes, and liquor bottles strewn across it before slamming into a table. Gravity continued to increase until Bin Musaid's body felt as though it was being pressed to the floor by the hand of God. The breath went out of him, and urine ran down his leg as his universe contracted until it consisted only of blinding sunlight, the deafening roar in his ears, and the unbearable force of gravity. Then, as quickly as it had started, it was over. The pressure subsided, and the scream of the engines returned to the reassuring hum he had spent so much of his life surrounded by. Blue, unwavering sky glowed beyond the windows, and he fixated on it, gulping air as he tried unsuccessfully to stand. The pilot appeared, hovering over him for a moment before dropping a phone onto his chest. Bin Musaid took it in a shaking hand and put it to his ear. A moment later, Ali Nassar's voice came on. Do we understand each other, Your Highness? Chapter 9. East of Manassas, Virginia, USA. Let's see if they finally added me to this thing, Coleman said, sticking his arm through the open window and pressing his thumb against the scanner. After a brief delay, the gate in front of them began to open. Rapp's subdivision was situated in a rural area outside of Washington, D.C., and had originally consisted of 10 large home sites to be sold off at market price. His obscenely rich brother had swooped in and bought the other 9, leaving Rapp with 100 acres on the top of a butte surrounded by farmland. It was a nice gesture, but had the effect of making his house too remote. The 9th Armored Division could roll up to his gate and go unnoticed for a week. Ever the idea man, Stephen had sold off the luxury lots to Rapp's friends and colleagues for $1 apiece,
A retired Secret Service man had already broken ground on one to the north, and Mike Nash's wife had finally decided on one to the east. "That's mine," Coleman said, pointing through the windshield at a wooded knoll next to the barn that Anna was preparing for the pony she was certain would be arriving for her birthday. "I'm thinking Western Contemporary. Something that'll give me a little class, you know." Rapp nodded silently. It wasn't a solution that he'd have come up with on his own. But it was the kind of out-of-the-box thinking that had his brother edging up on billionaire status. Within 2 years, Rapp would be surrounded by shooters completely loyal to him, as well as a few kids around Anna's age. A perfect scenario for everyone involved. All he had to do now was not screw it up. They came over a small rise, and the spotlit wall surrounding his house came into view. The copper gate swung back as they approached, and Rapp frowned. Claudia had undoubtedly activated it based on the security camera displays. With the glare of the headlights, though, it would be impossible for her to see through the windshield to confirm their identities. He'd have to talk to her about that. The modern single-level house had been designed mostly by his late wife. His only demand was that it have no exterior windows. She and her architect had done an incredible job of camouflaging the thick walls, reinforced roof, and defensive positions. Coleman swung the vehicle in a circle and came to a stop next to a spectacularly ugly sculpture that Claudia loved. "Looks like a sky crane lost its grip on a Hyundai and it landed in your yard," the former SEAL said. Rapp ignored the comment and stepped out into the cool night. He slammed the door and leaned through the open window. "You coming in?" Coleman shook his head. "I hear you've got 12 little girls in there. That's an opposing force I'd prefer to avoid." Instead of turning away, Rapp continued to grip the edge of the car door. "Things are going good?" "Better every day. They say I might be able to jog a quarter mile on the track next month. Anything to get me out of that lap pool, you know?" Rapp started to pull back, but then stopped when Coleman leaned painfully across the seat toward him. "I have one more thing to say about Claudia." "You're pushing it, Scott. What are you going to do? Hit a man who walks with a cane?" "Maybe." "You need to put yourself in her shoes for a minute, Mitch. If your wife had lived and you'd had a kid, would you have given everything up? The rush? The satisfaction of doing something you're good at? Would you have just turned yourself into a stay-at-home father? Because that's what you're asking her to do. Good night, Scott." Rapp watched him pull through the gate and then started for the front door. The normally spotless entryway was strewn with shoes, tiny backpacks, and a trail of colorful Legos that for some reason led into the powder room. Much of the house consisted of floor-to-ceiling glass that looked into an elaborately landscaped courtyard. He crossed it and used a sliding door to access the industrial kitchen his architect had convinced him he needed. The dark-haired woman inside wedged one last pan in the dishwasher and spun toward him. Her hair was a bit unkempt, and she had a smear of something that might have been mustard on one cheek. But she was still stunning. Rapp indicated to the dishes stacked everywhere. "I take it the rumors of a sleepover are true." "You may want to go back to Iraq where it's safe," she said, striding across the stone floor and throwing her arms around him. He returned the embrace hesitantly. Whenever they touched, he felt the same confusing combination of adrenaline and peace. The fact that he was becoming increasingly dependent on that sensation worried him. Those kinds of addictions never worked out well. She pulled away and went back to cleaning. "Have you eaten? I'm sorry, I haven't had a minute to make you anything." He took a seat at the large island and searched the dishes piled on it, finally selecting a hot dog with a tiny nibble out of one end. "I'm fine. Looks like you've had your hands full." "You have no idea," she said, switching to the French she preferred. "Your operation went well? All of your friends are safe." "More improvisation than I would have liked," he responded, taking a bite of the cold hot dog. "But everyone's in one piece." "And Joe?"
Things went well with his first command? It felt strange talking about these kinds of things with her. He'd done everything possible to keep his work hidden from his wife. But Claudia had been part of a similar world for years. She understood what he was dealing with. What was at stake? Could have been better. She stopped loading dishes into the sink and turned toward him. Everyone's okay, though, right? He reached for a bag of potato chips. Yeah, but it was a bust. Really? What happened? He examined her as she leaned against the sink. It was an odd question. While they were in the habit of discussing his work in general terms, he never went into specifics, and she knew better than to ask. What had changed? One of the pillars of effective interrogation was knowing more than your opponent thought you did. He had a feeling that he was on the wrong side of that now. Had Coleman given her details about Maslick's failed operation in the hope that he could recruit her? No way. The former SEAL was famously tight-lipped. And that left only one possibility. Irene. Just some bad luck, Rapp said. She fixed her almond-shaped eyes on him in a way that suggested she knew that she'd overplayed her hand. Nothing could have been done. Act of God, Rapp said, going out of his way to be as vague as possible. He recognized that the conversation was inevitable, but at least he could make her work for it. She finally admitted defeat. Did Scott talk to you about me? Yes. You're a very infuriating man to have a conversation with. He finished the hot dog. Really? I'm thinking about buying another sculpture for the front, she said. This one's much larger. He fought back a grin. Okay, truce. Scott and I talked, but I don't think it's a good idea. Why not? Because it's dangerous enough just being around me without getting involved in my business, and because Anna needs you here. It's not operations, Mitch, you know that. And you also know that you're putting too much pressure on Joe and Marcus. You're going to break them. Claudia, I'm not finished. Fine. Continue. You have a life, a purpose, challenges. I love being with Anna. But I can't just do that. What happens in a few years when she doesn't want her mother hovering over her every minute? You say Joe's operation didn't go well. Let me ask you something, and I want an honest answer. Would it have been different if I'd been involved? The answer was a solid probably. She was talented and incredibly exacting. It was possible that she could have ID'd the prince well before things got critical, and almost certain that she'd have been maintaining a reliable link to Langley. I don't know, Rapp said. But maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I can help keep you and Scott's people safe. From his office, not from the field. I just have a bad feeling about this, Claudia. I understand what you're saying. But there are a lot of jobs out there that don't involve so many fireworks. Why not get one of those? You can't tell me who I can and cannot work for, Mitch. That was true. She was essentially his roommate, a fact that was very much not lost on her. Why was it always the strong, defiant women he was attracted to? A doormat would make his life so much easier. Can we continue this conversation later? He asked. Is that a delaying tactic, or are we really going to continue later? Between her and Coleman, it was like stereo bitching. Just let me take a shower and sleep on it, okay? We'll pick it up again when we've taken back control of the house. The fact that she returned to the dishes suggested she was satisfied, so he grabbed the bag of chips and started toward the master suite. On the way, though, he stopped in Anna's open doorway. The girls were all dead asleep, on the bed, on the floor, sprawled across stuffed animals. A powerful reminder that outside of his world, everyday life kept marching on.
In a way, this was what he fought for. Sleepovers.
Chapter 10. Near Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.